Welcome to Love Nature, a presentation of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. In this episode, we meet Christy Hamilton. Christy is a science journalist who has written for Wired, Science Magazine, Business Insider, and other publications. Her book, Nature's Wild Ideas, is now available. We would appreciate it if you would share this podcast and subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can find Love Nature at love-nature.org, and you can explore our museum at naturalsciences.org. Now, here are our hosts, CEO and Director of the Museum, Dr. Eric Dorfman, and Chief Veterinarian and Director of Veterinary Sciences, Dr. Dan Dombrowski.
Christy, welcome to the show. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, great to have you and excited to talk to you today. Our first question for you, or my first question, is really about the combination between having a degree in neuroscience and a degree in journalism. That sounds kind of crazy. So I want to hear about that. But as a science journalist, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how those degrees and interests have got you to where you are?
Yeah, it's definitely a circuitous path for me. So I think as a journalist, you're often very curious about a lot of things. Mm. So I went to university and I first applied for a global health major. I switched to environmental science, and then I got a neuroscience and journalism degree. So I stayed in school for about 5 years because I was just wandering at the beginning, kind of exploring my interests. And I think in hindsight, you can kind of see how my interests come together.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was very much like an existential teenage crisis.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Wow. So that just seems like such a cool combination. We love talking to guests that sort of come from different science backgrounds and bring art and journalism together. That's awesome. I think that's pretty cool. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your current career and sort of, again, what you're up to right now and what you're doing with your journalism?
Yeah. So I'm primarily an environmental science and popular science journalist. And I investigate sort of natural world events that affect diversity of creatures, but it can also affect, going back to global health, it can also affect the people that live on those lands. So how are creatures, lands, the people who live on those lands, how are we all interconnected? And how is science trying to help us, you know, solve some of these issues? So, like I said, it does kind of combine all of my interests, but it can seem kind of scattered.
And I think it's all connected. I think it's a good point in the connections between, you know, the environment and the animals and nature and land and people and us. Mm. And so even as a veterinarian and with, you know, studies in health or practicing medicine, there's so many crossovers, you know, and this idea of one health and we all kind of live in a fishbowl, and it's hard to isolate one part or the other. You know, whether that's in study or I would assume in journalism.
Well, I think that's what we love working so much at the museum, a museum as well, that we've got this really front-facing component of what we do, but then there's this really deep science that is really integrated into everything that we're...
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right.
I think that's a good way to put it. I'm really interested in the connection between these spaces. And if you think about what the book is about, which is biomimicry, right? It's interdisciplinary. It's about all sorts of disciplines coming together to solve a design challenge. And so I'm really interested in those connecting pieces, like you say.
Yes. And you know, and funny, of course, we have millions of specimens in our collection storage, and we're, I mean, that it seems like the bodies of these animals, when you look at them, there's just this whole treasure trove of ideas waiting to be unlocked by people who are interested, which of course is one of the things, and we want to get back more in depth to your book specifically in a minute, but I'm really interested in thinking about, so you've got these disparate parts of your psyche and your career. What brought you together to think about biomimicry specifically as the topic of your book?
Yeah. So as a journalist, I was seeing these stories about innovation and invention in medicine and in, you know, astrophysics and in chemistry. And oftentimes I would look into the papers and they would mention their source of inspiration. Mm. And I was always so fascinated that they were looking at the natural world. But if you looked at the news releases, we were just focusing on the end product, not how right. we got yeah. to yeah. the end product. And it was that journey that I found so fascinating. And then it's also coming at this time where we're losing more creatures than we ever have at an incredible rate. So we're losing this diversity. And yet it seemed like over time, we're actually looking to this diversity in science to help solve some of our design challenges. And so there was this tension there that was really fascinating to me. And I wanted to explore it further.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I noticed that in a number of the chapters, really, that like there's a almost a subtext. It's a bit bittersweet, like thinking about the giraffes, right? And there's a number of different things that come from bioinspiration around giraffes. And yet their habitat is going through fragmentation and being hunted for their tails for fly swatters. I mean, there's like, it's a terribly tragic story. And as you point out, when there's so much that something so well known as a giraffe can actually offer us, but then there's all these other species that nobody knows anything about that are also going down the tube. So there's really, it's a double-edged sword with kind of almost every single example. So it kind of makes the theme running through your book is this we know so little and yet it's slipping through our fingers.
Yeah, I really wanted to try to bridge that gap that I think we've found ourselves in, where we use nature, we are inspired by nature, and so much good for humanity has come from nature, and yet we also decimate nature. Mm. And I wanted to create a greater intimacy with these creatures. So I describe them and I describe the inventor's journey, right?
Right.
But I also yeah. wanted to describe how are we kind of putting cracks in that intimacy that we used to have with these creatures, and how are we distancing ourselves from them, and can we bring ourselves closer and try to live in a greater, with greater kindness and understanding and symbiosis towards the natural world.
That kindness is so critical.
With so many stories, you know, it's like, it's cool to see one of our previous guests, Adrian Smith, is a researcher here at the museum, and he had that similar perspective on research and publishing. He, you know, his thing was that the end goal of science and research is to publish, but that's kind of just the end of it. What's really interesting to him was this like story leading up to it, and how you find the little discoveries and along the way how this develops. And I really took that away from your book. These were stories where, you know, lots of times these were individuals that were sort of on a journey, and you really talk about that, how you led or how they led up to those discoveries. With so many stories, there's so much material out there. How did you choose the stories to put in your book? Like, how did you figure out which ones you wanted to tell?
Yes, now that's a good question. And it might not at first sound like a very sexy answer. So what I did was I created a spreadsheet. And I began gathering all these stories because, like I said, I was just personally interested in them. I thought at first, like, maybe it would make a great column, or, you know, maybe it'd make a great podcast. Like, I wasn't quite sure what my format was going to be yet, but I kept collecting these stories and links to the papers. And then I began sort of forming this picture of how I wanted it, but I needed to see if there was enough material behind those ideas, yeah, right? And right. so I began investigating the stories. I began contacting the researchers. For this book, I think I interviewed more than 50 people. Wow. Some of whom are in the book, some of whom just provide me with background information, or honestly, scientists are the best at describing their own work, right? Yeah. Kind of help with creating a greater creativity almost behind it, right? Because they provide great metaphors often for you to try to understand the material. And so I contacted them, and I also wanted to present the stories that I felt like haven't really been told in the media so much, because the stories that have been told, I was always sort of like depressed by in some ways. You'd hear about like gecko tape inspired by gecko feet, and I'm like, that's not as cool as, like, you know, a telescope that's on a satellite headed towards Mercury, or these like $1 million invention Nobel Prize invention. Like, why haven't we heard those stories? Why are we hearing about tape, you know, that nobody actually uses that much of, because it's still kind of in its development phase? I was just so fascinated at how these stories were not yet told, but they had such a big impact in our lives.
I bet the folks you interviewed, were they really excited to tell you all about their work?
Oh my gosh, it's one of my favorite things, honestly, to do, is to interview scientists, because they're so passionate. They work on something for sometimes decades, right? And then you have this person, say like a muscle scientist, you know, like muscles don't move very much.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't get a lot of interviews, kind of.
Right, thing, right? Yes, that's it.
And so when someone's like, I find this so fascinating, they're just like, let me tell you everything.
Right, yes, yeah, that's it.
Yeah. About muscles,
I'm afraid I do that sometimes, so I understand.
Well, you know, and reading this book, there's so much that I learned. I mean, you know, I've got a career in biology, but I still, like, lotuses cleaning their own leaves. Like, how cool is that? Like, and, you know, I've always noticed the drops on the lotus leaves, but to realize that that's actually structurally to keep things from floating and sticking to these big leaves. So I'm wondering, with so many different examples of cool stuff, would you be willing to read something from your book? Would love you to read a passage that you find particularly resonant.
Sure. Let me do that now. Okay, so some background on this one before I start, because it is hard to kind of like choose one passage in a book without some context. So the context here is how ants and bees have inspired scientists to look at antimicrobials, because as you may know, antimicrobial resistance is a huge challenge in medicine right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Course.
Clint Pennock is a former punk musician turned ant scientist who is hoping the tiny critters can inspire us in the medical world too. His obsession with ants has deep roots. His first music band was called Army Ants, and he helped launch ants into outer space as a postdoctoral researcher at North Carolina State University. The ants were taken from a small mining town in North Carolina called Spruce Pine and drafted into the space program in 2014 as among some of our smallest astronauts yet. It was all part of a citizen science project for children to compare ants aboard the International Space Station with those in their classroom and document whether the astro ants behaved any differently than the Earth-based ants. In other experiments, Pennock has estimated that ants on Broadway in New York City eat the equivalent of 60,000 hot dogs per year. It's safe to say ants have been an obsession for him for as long as his guitar, except his research papers get more coverage than his music. That's fine by him, he says. He does, however, miss the stage dives. These days, Pennock is an assistant professor at Kennesaw State University and studies ants' antimicrobial properties. Social insects live in dense, teeming colonies of thousands to millions with a high probability of disease transmission. Some species even pass food to each other through mouth-to-mouth feeding, an ideal pathway for bacteria to exploit and decimate nests. Most ants in a colony are related, so if one ant is susceptible to a pathogen, it's likely the others are too. To top off in an already dizzying list of why ants shouldn't exist, their home turf is, or at least should be, a mecca for microbes. Their nests are warm, moist, bountiful, the perfect environment for unwanted bacteria to thrive. And yet, ants defend against such nuisances with a suite of homemade antimicrobials. In a high-risk environment, ants have gained the upper hand after millions of years of evolution, and scientists are looking to their pathogen defenses as a source of inspiration for vital antimicrobials. More than 2.8 million people in the United States each year are infected with antibiotic-resistant pathogens. 35,000 of those people die. Public health experts warn of a global crisis in treating infectious diseases. And research says Penick could help scientists develop new antibiotics in the fight against human diseases.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I love this, the hot dog statistic. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah. 60,000. My goodness.
But, you know, that really does bring up the point that something so familiar as an ant has so much to its way of life, its biology that we wouldn't even think about. And that's one thing that's so wonderful about this book is just opening up these different pathways of thinking about about the world around us.
And those are just the ants we know. I mean, we don't even know all the ants.
Right. Exactly.
So I have an observation. I think this really played into your book as I read it. And I've always kind of had this feeling and even experienced this as a veterinarian, as a scientist. So many, scientists, when they're working and make discoveries or figure things out, it seems like a lot of times it's accidental or they're looking for one thing and they find something else. And sometimes that leads to like huge discoveries. What do you think about that? Did you sort of see that come to light in your research?
Yes, serendipitous discoveries, as I like to call them. One perfect example of that is a chemist who was going to the beach essentially just to collect mussels, right? And he happened to be a chemist in glue. So he helped create the glues that we use everywhere from Apple stickers to our furniture to our airplane wings. So he's a glue scientist, which is fascinating to me in itself, right? And he saw how these mussels that he was trying to collect were sticking themselves to a wet surface. And this wet surface is, you know, covered in waves during some part of the day. And then other times, scorching heat is, you know, is pounding down at them. And how do they create a glue to stick to the rock when it's wet, when it's hot, and really made it difficult for him to grab them? Like, it's a strong glue for a tiny little creature. And they only use a couple droplets. And so he was fascinated by, like, how can just a couple droplets be so strong? And that's, you know, that was a serendipitous discovery, but one that has had massive implications again for us.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. So something that I was thinking about, you know, there's so many things we've been exploring all sorts of things today, thinking about talking to you, but there's just a couple of examples that made me think something, which was, you talked about fog harvesting. And then also there was the section around bees removing limits to human expansion. And the question that I've got, just for your opinion around this, is that a good thing? Is the are we already at this place? I'm thinking about the Green Revolution, right? That removed limits to our expansion by giving more food to more people, so that we could have more people in more places. And now we've got the problem with climate change because those more people are in more places. Yeah. And so the question, I guess, is, you know, if we're talking about environmental goods and services, and this is something that we're, you know, in a sense, the biomimicry is allowing us greater access to environmental goods and services. The question is, is that good? I don't know. Like, and just, this is sort of this is more of a philosophical thing than like what you think, having looked at all these different stories.
And do you mean in terms of us tapping nature or us sort of growing as a population?
Well, I guess that's the thing, tapping nature to grow in a population. Yeah. Like, at what point do we want to say, okay, let's let those secrets stay secret so that we don't expand. This is just philosophical. I don't necessarily have an opinion about it, but it is something that I was thinking about reading your book. At what point are we are we unlocking something that's going to allow us to do more damage to ourselves with an even bigger population? I guess that's the question.
Yeah. I'm going to answer that sort of in two parts.
Sure.
And I think biomimicry, which is really interesting, has a philosophical component like you're mentioning. I think by realizing this symbiosis with nature, we have to ask those big questions for ourselves, right? It's not just to do more and more inventions. The idea here, and I think sometimes the scientists even mention this, is that it's not about more. It's about purposeful invention.
Right.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Trying to be more purposeful with our work and also trying to harness energy in a way that is less destructive to the planet, which is becoming a bigger field in biomimicry. I would say it's first started more in medicine, and it's now kind of moving into the green energy revolution, as many departments are with climate change. And I think that those big personal questions in terms of humanity are so important to ask. And we really can't just explode as a population and expect that we can survive soundly and well on this planet, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Our ability to enter space and go explore other planets is certainly not up to par yet. So we really do have to preserve this planet. And part of that preservation might be having to ask ourselves the difficult questions like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Along those lines, I had a similar sort of question. Was really about, it seems like when we make a discovery, we immediately try to optimize and mass produce, and we go all in so quickly without sometimes realizing the side effects or the long term payback for doing that. And so even things that are awesome, like the fog harvesters or even solar panels across the desert, like what happens when we tap those resources in a new way that we've not really done before? What about the things that rely on the fog, or how does that then sort of backfire sometimes in the environment, or if the desert's covered by solar panels? You had done another article about the desert's fragile skin. Like how does that play into these technologies and discoveries and advancements?
Yeah, it's this really fragile line, right? You don't want to wait so long, I think, as scientists often do, right, to have a perfect understanding.
Yeah.
And we hope it's a perfect understanding, and then something just like sort of throws a curve in that. But you also don't want to do it too fast, that ultimately it just becomes more waste. And what we see in industry, and I think it's so important to mention, is that industry is hard to change. Right. So if you look at our concrete industry, the main hurdle there is that we just can't get them to change. There's so much infrastructure behind it that people are like, well, it'll cost so much money for us to change. So we also don't want to introduce something new because people clearly don't like change. It costs
right. Yes, change. Of course.
Right. And so it's this interesting push-pull question. And that's why you want to get so many eyes on the matter. Yeah. Right. I think there's an example where I kind of show biomimicry failing in the book too, which was just not enough eyes were on the invention that people wanted to make. They read a paper and they were like, oh, I have an idea. And this was the bird chapter, actually. So how UV windows were inspired by spider webs to prevent birds from crashing into them. Well, it turns out these really expensive UV windows perform less well than just simple stickers on windows.
Right.
And again, we have to ask ourselves this question, like, well, they're trying to make windows that we can see through unobstructed, right? An unobstructed view.
Right. Yes.
And we can't see UV, and maybe birds can, which they can to a degree.
Yeah.
Birds have their different species, so different birds can see UV to certain degrees. And it's kind of this question, again, like a philosophical question that we have to ask ourselves, which is how important is our bird diversity, our bird population to us compared to our need for a perfect clear view? Because we really good solutions that cost so little, but we're unwilling to kind of move in that direction because we want to be able to see perfectly out the window. And so we have to sometimes ask ourselves those questions, like, is this where we put our resources? Does this make sense? I think it's an important question.
I think that's true. You know, something, and you did have the sort of who cares moment, the, you know, that when you were talking to someone, about changing our priorities and what are we willing to live with for the greater good, and how, and I think a lot about this too, that the idea that sometimes it's a matter of scale. You know, if we can think 100 years in the future, 1,000 years in the future, instead of 10 minutes in the future, how is that going to inform the societal choices, the infrastructure choices that we make now? And it's and certainly as I was reading the book and looking at all these different examples, so much of the questions that you pose about here is what nature is offering us, how are we squandering that opportunity? That's all about, just like the bird safe windows is just become so palpable.
Yeah. And in your book, in your other articles too, I mean, you have a lot of hope and you're really positive in the presentation. What gives you inspiration? Like was there a time or an experience that you had that really has inspired you in your journalism for science?
I love to do field work. So I love to see these creatures in their natural spaces. And kind of going back to that like philosophical discussion, which I actually love that you guys are bringing up, because I feel like biomimicry is so one-dimensional often in the media. And I love that we're having this like much more 3D discussion about biomimicry. And that's like another reason why I wanted to write this book, because it's not perfect for everything. It's perfect for very, you know, specific things, and it can serve us in a certain way, but not in every way.
Yeah.
And I really found this gray area of biomimicry so fascinating, because I think there is this philosophical concept about preserving nature, and honestly, giving kudos to evolution after all these years, right? Because if you look at nature, nature starts small, right? For us humans, we actually tend to design large, and it's harder for us to get smaller. But nature starts small and will design bigger. And so it really thwarts how we even start a design project when we look at nature. It just provides a different foundation for us to view the world, because we have this like so narrowed lens. We live in this like certain, you know, size of the world, but most of the creatures on this planet, we're on the extreme. We're on actually the big side of most on this planet. But if you think about how we talk about creatures, we talk about the polar bears that we can see, you know, like the big creatures. And so we tend to think that creatures are around our same size on this planet. But, you know, 90% of them are actually smaller than us. They're smaller creatures, most of which we can't even see, you know, and trying to just shift our perspective, because we're so siloed sometimes. Yeah. And different creatures can see in UV, right? Or they can see different slices of the world in ways that we can't. So it's exploring how creatures interact with the world and getting outside our own brains, our own way of seeing this world, in a perspective shift. And part of that perspective shift, like you guys are saying, might be a philosophical perspective shift as well.
Well, nice. Yeah, I love the idea that, you know, all of our senses are so limited. So in science, I mean, we can only see things in a certain range of size and only in a certain light. You know, we our smell is not very good. Our sight is not, you know, it's limited compared to other creatures and other things in nature. When we make a discovery, you know, like a microscope, all of a sudden we can apply that new discovery or that new technology to all the things we know and take them a little bit further. Right. And I felt like that came out a lot in these stories, where it was like some of these started, you know, down one road and sort of ended at a level or got to a point, but then they could apply this new technology from a collaborator from some other, you know, area of science and advance it then much further. So
what gives you inspiration, you know, as a, you know, some of these things, you know, we talked about the future and there's a lot of sadness when we think about what we're doing to the planet. And yet you do have a really hopeful perspective on this. And are there, species or experiences or places that replenish you personally as an author?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I spend a lot of my time in nature. Mm. My hobby is climbing. To do climbing, it's not, if you go to a gym, you know, it can be a couple hour thing, but I mainly climb outside. So it's often much more of an expedition to get to these places. It can be like a full 3-day weekend, you know, trying to just, you have to get there, you have to hike in there. Then when you are there, it's very much about understanding the wall when you're there. And so one, my sport is very embedded in nature, but I also just feel like when you do take time away from like the hecticness of the everyday world and you really just devote your time to nature and you give yourself those moments, it's so interesting how time slows down even just how you view the world completely changes. And it can be 3 days out in nature with no internet, no mirrors, you know, nothing to sort of like reflect the world back at you, but you to sort of see yourself as part of the environment and how are you interacting with the world. It completely shifts your perspective because often we have all this information coming in at us and we're trying to like piece it together in this way that, you know, creates our identity with those around us. And then we see mirrors in every single room of our house.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
It makes us sort of like lose this connection that we have with the environment around us because we're so in our heads.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of my time out in nature just to sort of reconnect myself with that, what I kind of call it like a slower way of living, but it often makes me think deeper. Like I often have deeper thoughts, I feel like, when I'm there because they're less interrupted. It's less just about me, but it's more about the connections between things and me and nature and the environment or the plants and the soil and the animals that rely on the plants that rely on the soil, you know, that kind of connection.
Yeah, that's amazing. Did you do that as a kid? Like, were you out in nature as a young person?
Yes and no. So I was out in nature. I was not out in nature in the sense of doing sports. So my mom's a doctor. My dad's a scientist. My mom also does nature photography.
Oh, wow.
And so we would go out and we would observe nature, essentially. Right. So that was kind of our vacations, is we would go and observe nature and she would take photographs and we would kind of just play with sticks and dirt when she was doing her photography.
Yeah.
So the sport element kind of came later, which for me is sometimes sad because I'm like, oh man, I wish I was so much better at climbing. At the same time, I'm really appreciative that I had these moments where we just spent and lived time in nature, you know, and I got to have that intimacy and appreciation for it.
Do you have a favorite place or a favorite spot in nature or a favorite habitat? Take us away to one of your places that you rock climb or that you visited that's had a real impact on your life?
Yeah, well, I love Yosemite. I was born and raised in California. So Yosemite is where we went the most as a child and it's where I'm the most familiar with. And it's also sort of the mecca of rock climbing. And we're seeing it more in documentaries now, right? But it also had its own kind of like tribe and culture growing up. And I'm also very attracted to sort of more extreme landscapes like deserts or ice climbing in Bozeman, Montana. You know, I'm by no means a cold creature. Like I don't gravitate towards cold environments, or at least I don't exist very well in them. I guess I gravitate towards them, but I don't exist very well in them because, you know, I was raised in California. I do much better in warm weather. But I am sort of fascinated by these extremes. So going to deserts and living in a desert for a while, you know, going to Bozeman, Montana and living in the ice and cold for so long. And what you learn is you do adapt fairly quickly. Like it is a shock to the system. And I think sometimes a good shock to the system. Yeah. And then you adapt faster than you expect yourself to. So, but Yosemite, if I had to choose Yosemite all the way.
Awesome. Oh, I like it.
Yeah, gorgeous.
So now you've published your book and you've got some amazing articles out there. What's next? What projects are on your horizon?
that you can tell us about.
That you can tell us about.
Well, so talking about inspiring the next generation, this is an adult nonfiction book, but I'm working on adapting this book for children and hoping that children in schools and stuff can use this and be inspired by, you know, plants and animals. And, you know, I create, it's a much more fantastical in many ways, right? Because you really want to get them excited and they love creatures. I think often kids really love learning about animals and plants and stuff. Yeah. And so we're working on adapting this book for children to read.
So Christy, thank you very much. It was great to meet you and great to talk to you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed this conversation.
So that was a lot of fun meeting Christy and talking about her new book, Nature's Wild Ideas. One of the stories that we didn't get to or didn't get to ask her about was one of my favorites in her book about biomasonry. And actually a company here, I think in North Carolina, that's working on microbes that can grow walls and concrete blocks, basically, or replacements for concrete. So pretty cool story, kind of. A little science fiction there with some living masonry to think about in our futures. So many stories, so many innovative stories and inspiring stories about biomimicry in nature.
Thank you for listening to Love Nature. Please subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode. Also, please share Love Nature with others. All of the links mentioned in the show can be found at the show notes at love-nature.org. You can find our museum at naturalsciences.org. Love Nature is a production of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, located in beautiful downtown Raleigh, North Carolina.